When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
We seldom get much coastal action in this podcast for perfectly obvious reasons, but this week the sound of seabirds can be heard in the background, the scent of salt in our nostrils, and a breeze blowing gently over us. This week we've crawled up between the non-existent roadworks on the A12 to meet a team of people who are going to be setting about conducting an unusual survey of the Thames this very weekend, a survey of marine life. They've got a sense of porpoise. I just thought I'd get it out of the way. It is Saturday, the 7th of March, 2015. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Ipswich Out Loud.
Hey, baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sound. You ain't never seen the light before, just a long through from your front door.
Hello, hello, listener. We are on water as this episode of Londonist Out Loud begins, and we're not in London at all. We're in Ipswich. For those of you perhaps not familiar with England, Ipswich is about 60, 70 miles east, northeast of London. And for those of you in London, England is a green expanse with villages and towns, and it surrounds London. We're here to look at marine life, and the specimen of marine life in front of me is Richard McClanagan. He is the director of MCR. He is occasionally the skipper of the boat we're standing on in the marina at Ipswich. Hi, Richard.
Hi, thank you for coming to visit us.
We must start with what the devil we're doing here.
So we're standing on the deck of the research vessel Song of the Whale, which is based out of Ipswich and belongs to the organisation called Marine Conservation Research. Marine Conservation Research is a small non-profit specialising in, as the name implies, in conservation issues around the marine environment. Particular area of expertise is the study of whales and dolphins, or cetaceans, and within that field our sort of core competence is in the use of acoustics. So we use the sounds that whales and dolphins make to find the animals, to count them using the sounds, and to track them. And the reason we do this is because, as you'll realise, whales and dolphins spend the majority of their lives underwater. So if you're trying to survey them to understand their distribution, merely looking with your eyes for an animal that spends most of its time underwater isn't a very efficient way of working. So by trailing hydrophone arrays, and those are very sensitive underwater microphones, behind the boat, we're able to pick up the sounds that they make, localise on them, count them, as I mentioned, and work out what's going on in the area we work in. And the reason we're here in Ipswich is MCR is based locally, so this is where we keep the boat, but the reason we're talking about London today is we're about to leave Ipswich, bound for the Thames estuary and ultimately up the Thames and into London, conducting a harbour porpoise survey. And harbour porpoises are a very small relative of the dolphin. They're quite coastal, generally speaking, and used to be very common in the Thames estuary and even up the river, right up the river as far as Teddington.
Can I just say, everybody I've told so far doesn't believe you. When I mentioned to them a porpoise survey, they all said, well, that's easy, none.
Well, that's fair comment, I suppose, because as I'm sure you know, all Londoners know, for many years the Thames was very, very heavily polluted, and at one point in the 50s was declared as being biologically dead, which point there were very few fish, very few seals or porpoises in the river. But in the ensuing years, there's been huge efforts made to clean up the river, and it's now very, very clean. In fact, I'm sure Ollie and Anna, who you'll meet down below in a little while, will talk about the numbers of different species that are now found in the river.
Of cetacean or of marine life?
Of marine life generally, but it's also known that porpoises are now seen from time to time in the river itself, and very definitely in the estuary. But no one has ever done a dedicated survey to see just how many porpoises are using the river, and if there are specific areas that are kind of hotspots for them. So that's what we're embarking on today.
So this is the first one?
This is the first survey of its kind, and we're hoping that this will become a fairly regular occurrence. We're certainly planning to do a second survey during the summer months this year.
We're going to have a poke around the boat in just a moment, but you must have made some sort of projections as to what you think you're going to find.
We haven't been quite so brave as to pick a number that we're going to find, but we're pretty confident that we'll find porpoises in the estuary and close up into the outer reaches of the river. Quite how far up the river we might find them, we don't know. I mean, there are anecdotal sightings, and there are even clips on YouTube that people have filmed from time to time on the river, seeing them there, but it's not been quantified in any way, and that's what we're aiming to do here, is to start the ball rolling on that. And also, as part of our projects, which is common in all the work we do, we're developing an education program as part of it, so there'll be some longevity to the project in that we're producing education materials, we're going into schools, putting stuff on the web, teachers' resources, that kind of thing.
We're on a strapping and I don't imagine cheap piece of equipment here, this beautiful boat. How did this come into being? How did you guys find each other?
In the late 80s, I was working in software engineering and then switched tack and went off and started sailing for a living, mostly working on bigger and bigger and very fancy boats, and that was all very nice and got to go to some beautiful places.
But you were doing this for a hobby already, or...?
Yeah, sailing had always been a hobby, but this was a way of starting to make a living doing something that, you know, I enjoyed doing. And then after a while, it started to feel a little bit pointless, and I thought I'd like to sort of marry my interest in conservation with sailing. And I heard about the Song of the Whale project, which had been running since 1987. And managed through my sailing skills and my background in computing and a little bit of electronics to get myself involved in that project, which at the time was run by a large UK-based NGO called the International Fund for Animal Welfare. I worked with them and I ran the predecessor to this boat and did that for many years. And in 2004, we built and launched this current Song of the Whale, which was a replacement from an earlier, much smaller vessel. And then in 2009, I4 restructured, and at that point, myself and other members of the long-term Song of the Whale team set up Marine Conservation Research as a consultancy, and then later on as a non-profit, to continue running the vessel to do the various marine research projects that we'd been undertaking under the IFOR banner for many years. And then during another sort of restructuring last year, IFOR granted ownership of the vessel to MCR. So we've comparatively recently have started in a new chapter of our existence.
Am I right in thinking that's several major goodwill junctions going on there in the life of the project?
It is, and you know, it's quite a big thing, obviously, for those of us still involved in the project and for I4 themselves. You know, they were keen to, as they were sort of changing direction, to see the project continue and to hopefully grow. But obviously, it's put us in an interesting situation. We're now in a situation where we're on the lookout for funding in a way that we never have had to before. So we're looking for individual and trusts and corporate sponsorship, that kind of thing. So it's a whole new world for us.
Well, as it struck me that we're both involved in sounds here, sending sound under the water and making noises above water at the moment. What would be the sales pitch then in terms of getting funding? What is the thing that you're for?
Well, we're doing the groundwork for conserving marine species, and in particular whales and dolphins, although we've worked on other things like sharks and seals over the years. And we're doing the groundwork for that to help sort of forge conservation measures and legislation for future generations. So we're basically trying to protect important marine species, not just in the UK but worldwide, for generations to come.
Let's turn our attention to the boat itself.
I suppose the first thing I should point out is that the Song of the Whale, you know, the initial reaction when you look at it is to say, oh, that there's a rather large, expensive looking yacht. But in fact, that's where the similarities stop, I suppose. It is a sailing boat, and it looks a bit like a yacht, but it was purpose designed for the acoustic research we do. And because we work offshore, mid-ocean a lot of the time, and the focus of our work is using acoustics, as you say, it's important that the boat is very quiet. So that's why we use a sailing boat. Not only is it quiet, but it's also comparatively cheap to run.
Is it to the extent that you see on submarine films where you have to keep your voices down while you're working?
It's not quite that bad, but I mean, there would be circumstances where Matt, who's the engineer who you might have seen wandering around, you know, if he's pounding away with a hammer at times, we might have to ask him to be quiet. But in terms of...
Well, you're in there, well, that's 20 whales in the last minute. That's incredible.
Exactly, yeah. No, it could... I mean, the hydrophones are that sensitive that it would pick that up. It's much more a case of things like the engines on here and the generators, things like that, have all been specially selected, and the way they're mounted to the hull and the propeller shaft, things like that, they've all been designed very specifically to minimise the amount of noise we're making and transmitting into the marine environment, because there's a disturbance aspect that, particularly if you're working close to whales, but also in terms of actually being able to hear what's going on, making a lot of noise yourselves, obviously you're not going to hear what else is going on.
So it's that whole thing from a sociology class that can't forget that the observer affects what's being observed.
Absolutely, yes. And from that perspective, part of our ethos is to develop and promote non-invasive techniques. So we are very much about sort of standing back and observing rather than sort of being very interventionist. So we are more typically, you know, one step further back than others might be.
I happen to know that hydrophones have been around since the First World War, because I know they were used to pick up the German U-boats in the Channel. What can we find out about hydrophonic technology? What I had in my mind when I asked that, I think specifically, is how far can you reach?
Okay, so what we're doing is we're listening. We're not transmitting a sound and listening to an echo coming back.
Oh, this is all on receive.
This is all on receive. And that's how submarines would be found as well a lot of the time, is by an operator sitting there. You know, if you think of the classic films with the chap sat with his hands cupped over his ears, we do very much the same sort of thing. Although, and certainly when I started in 1992, it was all sitting, concentrating with headphones on. But these days we have computers doing most of the listening for us. But in terms of how far we can hear a whale, right, that varies very much on the species itself. So, for example, with a sperm whale, which is the largest of the toothed whales, up to sort of 18 to 20 metres, we might hear those 15 to 20 kilometres away. With the harbour porpoise that we're going out to look for this week, a much, much smaller animal, which vocalises at a much higher frequency, and higher frequencies don't travel as well, we might only hear that out as far as 500 metres. But compare that to how far you might be able to spot it visually if there's any kind of sea running, that still gives you a much better chance of detecting the animal acoustically rather than visually.
So you've got to have some pretty good idea of roughly where to expect to find the animals in the first place.
Well, we, and Ollie and Anna can talk to you much more about this, but in terms of the way we search for animals, it's very much driven by a statistical methodology of laying out survey lines to get good coverage of an area.
And I don't know if this is an Ollie and Anna question as well, but if you've got a little bunch of porpoises perhaps together a distance away, are you able to tell exactly how many are in that group?
We can to a certain extent, and that is more of an Ollie-Anna sort of question, but with larger whales that tend to travel in groups that are more widely spread, it's certainly much easier. It's slightly harder to resolve the angles when you've got small animals relatively close to you that will likely be travelling very close together, but they can probably show you and talk you through what a porpoise detection looks like.
Let me plumb your skippering knowledge of the Thames estuary. What particular challenges are there going to be for the skipper on that mission?
Well, there's a couple of fundamental issues, I suppose. One is that there's a lot of sandbanks in the Thames estuary, so you've got a number of main shipping channels to work within, and this is a fairly deep draft boat that's designed primarily for offshore work, so we're quite restricted to working within those navigation channels, and we've been working closely with the Port of London Authority to agree our survey tracks, and through them in making sure that other shipping that's likely to be in the area is aware of what we're doing, and we can work together to make sure that we don't get in anyone's way. There are issues of depth as we go, and we're towing a hydrophone array, so we're going to have to vary the length of that accordingly to make sure we're not dragging it along the bottom.
Oh, so you've got a trailer on the back of this?
The hydrophone is on the end of a long cable.
Ah, we're looking at a drum right now, listener, that has, if you imagine the television of the 1920s, and you'd have your big old camera and then a drum of cable behind it, that's what's on the back here.
And it's almost exactly the same sort of cable, and then at the end of that is the hydrophone itself with the sensitive listening elements.
What does the hydrophone look like? Is it there already?
No. It is. I can show you what it looks like, and we can describe it. So within this oil-filled tube, there are, wrapped in a piece of sponge here, there's a very sensitive ceramic element, which is basically the microphone. And then the wire here is just feeding that into the tow cable, coming up and fed into the computer room down below that we'll look at in a minute, and that's where the sound is being processed. So normally when we're working offshore, these would be towing 400 metres behind the boat and at about a depth of 40 metres. Well, obviously in the Thames estuary, it's fairly shallow in certain points, so we will be towing a much, much shorter cable down to just 20 metres in some places, and particularly up in the busier parts of the river.
So combine that with the porpoise's smaller, weedier voices, then this is a precision operation.
It is. There's a lot goes into this.
Well, is there anything else we need to know about the boat itself before we head below decks?
Well, yeah, so I've been emphasising the acoustic side of our work, but we do visual observations as well, and somewhat unusually for a boat like this, we have a large tower on the close to the stern of the vessel, and we'll have three people standing up there during daylight hours on this trip, and they'll be looking out for porpoises and other marine life. There's a lot of seals to be found in the Thames estuary, and in fact one of our partners on this project is ZSL, the Zoological Society of London, and they run a seal survey in the estuary, and we'll be working with them and have some of their team on board, so we'll be logging sightings of seals as well. And then in some situations we also have someone posted in a much higher observation platform, which is halfway up the mast, but we won't be using that for this particular survey.
I know you've got some interns with you. I bet they all want to be volunteering to be crow's nest people.
Hopefully. I mean, quite often, even when we're just in harbour, people want to go up there just to go and try it out and see what the view's like. So,
Well, without further ado, let's move below decks and see what's going on there.
Let's make our way down and try not to bash our heads on the way in.
The clunking noise you're about to hear, listener, is me bashing my head on the way in.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to a CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/londonist and click through.
So down we come, and there are computer screens showing emails. This doesn't look very scientific.
Okay.
No, this station's much better. This has got dials and compasses.
Okay, so over on this is our main working area, although we have a copy of a lot of the gear that's down here is replicated up on deck, so we don't have to keep dashing up and down to for navigation purposes or for data entry for the scientific observations. But what we have here, this is the primary navigation station, so this is where all our navigation instruments and our communications equipment is housed. So it's where Brian, who's skipper for this trip, will spend much of his time.
And it looks far simpler than I could have imagined. I suspect that may be deceptive, though. We've got a bank of switches with lights on the right, and a PC like you might find at home, and then a couple of compasses.
Essentially,
sounds too easy.
Yeah, no, it is. It's much more straightforward in many ways than it was years ago. You know, everything's been nicely integrated into lots of sophisticated electronics, but so long as all that's working, then it's all should be well and good.
I want to ask Brian something. May I ask you something?
Of course.
I've often thought this about bus drivers, and we've just been talking about the liaison with the Port of London Authority and making sure that the route's all planned out and so forth. Do you ever just want to go on, stop this, foot down?
Yeah, occasionally you do. Sometimes there's a lot of rules and regulations that you need to follow that you can't really see why yourself, and like you say, we could just go there. But yeah, particularly when you're going to be in the Thames for quite a long time, it makes sense to get on with them and try and follow the rules.
I've just realised where my question might have come from, having come up the A12 with 40 mile an hour restrictions for non-existent roadworks.
I
think I'm bitter. What's in the cupboard here?
This cupboard is our computer room. This is Ollie, who's the sort of senior scientist with MCR and is leading the research on this project.
This is Oliver Boisseau.
That's right.
Hi. You're clutching a piece of equipment here that this looks like the back of a mainframe computer.
Essentially, yes. So what we're looking at the moment in our computer room is a stack of computers. They're just standard desktop PCs that you could buy in any high street shop. And we've rigged them up with a series of buffer boxes, amplifiers, filters for all of our signal processing. So when Richard showed you the hydrophone on deck, the underwater microphone, that essentially gets plumbed in here below decks to the computer room. And so this bank of flashing lights we're looking at is where that signal will get processed, fed through to our computers. And a lot of the grunt work now is automated. So a lot of the nuts and bolts of what we're doing, which is trying to detect the vocalizations of these animals when they're below the surface, a lot of that work is done by bits of software we've developed over the last 20 or so years. So it basically makes our job a lot easier in that we can rely on the computers to try and find the animals for us.
But how far does it go? Can it tell you, you know, that's a porpoise, that's something else?
Yeah, so for certain species it's very effective. So fortunately for us, porpoises, hubble porpoises, make a very specific type of sound. So their echolocation clicks are ultrasonic, so they're above human hearing. So when we're towing our hydrophone in the water behind us, and if we listen to that audio stream with headphones, we can't actually hear the porpoises directly. So we do rely on the computers to do that filtering and deciphering for us. But fortunately, hubble porpoises produce these echolocation clicks in a very specific frequency band, about 130 kilohertz. And there isn't many other things out there in the water column that produce clicks at that frequency. So in a way, porpoises are very easy to work with. The downside of having a very high frequency system, such as the porpoises, is that the system is very directional, so that there's not much power in their clicks, and it's very directional. So if they turn towards our hydrophone and are within maybe 500 meters, we will be able to pick up their clicks. But if they turn away from us, we'll probably lose them. And also, if they're more than 500 meters or so, we probably won't be able to pick them up. So that's the downside of working with acoustics, is that it depends on the species, but sometimes if they're orientated away from us, they get a little bit harder to track. But we found over the years this system is much more effective, particularly for things like porpoises. They're very small, they're very inconspicuous, they don't leap out of the water like dolphins. They're very undemonstrative, they're very unshowy. They're quite small, they don't have a big dorsal fin like some of the dolphins. So anyway, they're very difficult to see. And on a flat, calm day, so today here in Ipswich, it's actually quite calm on the water. But it may be when we get down the Thames, there's a bit more slop, there's a bit more swell. May even be raining, and then it becomes very hard to see things, particularly these small, inconspicuous creatures at the surface. So then we really do rely primarily.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Early on our acoustics to find them.
I've got more acoustic questions, but you haven't really sold the porpoises to me. They sound a bit dull, to be honest. Are they endangered themselves? Is that why we're concerning ourselves with this particular species?
Yeah, harbour porpoises face a number of quite acute conservation threats. So porpoises themselves are found throughout the Northern Hemisphere, and they're actually found in most European waters. As the name implies, they are creatures of coastal waters, the harbour porpoise, so they do come into harbours, estuaries, lagoons.
Is that a good move for their own safety?
It's certainly good in terms of foraging, because the species, the fish they're trying to eat, basically live in these in certain areas, quite shallow waters and often near sandbanks and mudflats. So they're very much restricted in where they can and can't go. Oddly, for such a small species, they're maybe 1.5 meters maximum length, so it's quite small, smaller than an average adult, I suppose. They actually prefer cooler waters, which is odd because normally in the wild, mammals prefer, smaller creatures prefer warmer regions, and then the bigger animals prefer the slightly cooler areas, or they can tolerate those cooler areas. So the porpoise is a little bit unusual, and then it goes into the cooler waters to feed. So they're really living at the edge of their thermal limit, so they need to spend almost all their time foraging, looking for food. So that's partly why they're not quite as exciting, perhaps, as their cousins, the dolphins.
They're busy.
They're busy, yeah. They're getting on with life, they're feeding. The dolphins have a bit more time to play and frolic around. So they're very much limited in what they can and can't do, porpoises. But then on top of that, they tend to get, unfortunately, entangled in fishing nets, certain type of fishing nets. And again, it seems to be they're so focused on foraging, they're so focused on finding food, that they'll accidentally blunder into nets, certain types of nets, bottom set gill nets, which are basically nets on the seabed. And it just seems they're so distracted by the fish, their prey, they're moving in on their quarry. And then for some reason, their echolocation system, their sonar system fails, and they blunder into the nets. And because they're mammals like us, so they breathe air. If they get caught in a net, they'll unfortunately die if they can't get to the surface. So despite these porpoises being found throughout Europe, they actually do face these acute conservation threats, primarily from fishing. And there are other threats to them, such as noise. So if there are more porpoises coming into the Thames, which we hope is the case, there's a lot of construction noise. There's obviously noise related to vessels coming and going, so increasingly, not just in river systems like the Thames, but around the world, noise, anthropogenic or man-made noise, is becoming more of an issue. We're introducing more and more water into the water column. We're introducing more and more noise into the water column, sorry, and that is causing problems not just with whales and dolphins, but also all types of marine life. So even fish eggs can get damaged by certain types of anthropogenic noise in the water column. So the porpoises do face a number of threats, and they are listed under various international legislations. They are afforded a particular protection. So within European waters, the harbour porpoise is afforded a higher level of protection.
I don't know whether this steps on any political sensitivities. What are your thoughts on the fishing industry, the fishing techniques that are going on? Fishing practices, I should say.
Well, groups like ourselves at MCR, we always try to work as closely as possible with the fishing industry. So instead of us or other campaigning bodies pointing the finger, waving the finger at the fishing industry, it's much better to try and resolve these problems in a way that benefits both us and the animals, both humans and the animals. And there are certain measures that have been adopted in certain regions. So this problem with bycatch, the porpoises getting entangled in the nets, it's quite a big problem in the Baltic Sea, for example, slightly more remote region from here, but similar weather at times. And there's a number of the fisheries and the fishermen, the fishers, put on what are called pingers, these acoustic devices onto the nets, which in theory, as the name implies, pingers, they ping. And the idea is that these sonic pings will alert the porpoises to the presence of the nets, potentially even scare them away from certain areas. And so the jury's out, but this approach has met with some success. So there is evidence that the porpoises do stay away from these nets. So that's an area of potential interest in terms of managing this problem, this interaction between fisheries and porpoises. But we're slightly wary that in certain areas, for example, up in Scotland, there's numerous salmon farms, for example. And again, sometimes the fishermen use these pingers this time to actually scare seals away. But the same principle applies, so the seals stay away from the salmon, don't steal any of the salmon. But the concern is with so many of these fish farms in quite narrow confines, it could actually exclude porpoises, for example, from a really important habitat. Essentially, if you went to the canteen every lunchtime and there was a jackhammer working in the street and you decided you didn't want to eat your lunch there, very quickly you might get hungry if you couldn't go to the canteen. So
you've got to feel sorry for the salmon.
Well, that's right. Yeah, they've got a tough deal as well. But they have slightly different acoustic sensitivities. So again, with these pingers or these acoustic harassment devices, as they're sometimes called, they're tailor-made for the species of interest.
So this is like the mosquito noise to get teenagers to move away.
Yeah, exactly right. They can be tailored to specific creatures and the specific sensitivities. So anyway, there is scope for some more positive approach to this conflict, the bycatch problem.
For reasons of correctness, I should say, I think the London Underground, I don't think they do that. I think they use classical music instead, which you can have that idea on me.
Or maybe you can use it for the porpoises.
What else is acoustically down there that you could be listening into? You mentioned the various man-made noises, but on the sort of end of the spectrum that you're thinking of, what other sounds might you come across?
Well, many of the more shallow coastal regions, such as the estuary and working upriver into the Thames, we do tend to get a lot of crustaceans, shrimps. We call them clicking shrimps. Certain types of shrimp or little crustaceans do produce clicking sounds. And you'd imagine a tiny little shrimp buried away in the mud would actually be very quiet. But surprisingly, almost all the biological noise we can detect is dominated by snapping shrimp. These small crustaceans in shallow areas. A lot of our work is in slightly more remote areas, offshore ocean habitats, and there we won't hear a single snapping shrimp. But coming up somewhere like the estuary and the River Thames, we will hear a lot of snapping shrimp. And in a way, they have their own beauty because it's like a little symphony of it's like pouring your breakfast, oat milk in your breakfast cereal in the morning and hearing snap, crackle, and pop. It is like that, or frying bacon perhaps in a frying pan, this hissing, popping sound. It's quite nice in a way. It's just nice to hear creatures out there, even if it's not quite the species we're interested in, the porpoise.
I'd love to hear it. Have we got any samples or any way to hear under the water?
Yes, we do. We can play a recording of the porpoise, perhaps more appropriately. Let me get that ready for you. Probably over here is the best place. So this is an echolocation train from a harbour porpoise. So these are the sounds they produce to find their prey, so to feed and also to navigate and even to socialise. So they essentially use the same words, if you like, over and over again for lots of different things, for finding their way around, for playing, for socialising.
I know a lot of people who do that. and this is what you're going to be. This is the soundtrack to your weekend.
Exactly. So this is not so much what we're listening out for, but this is what the computers on board are going to be listening out for. Yeah, so that is actually, we've had to modify that slightly so we can hear it. So we've dropped the frequency down. Humans, well, young people tend to hear up to about 20 kilohertz is the upper limit of our hearing. The clicks, we we're listening to then from porpoises would have been produced at about 120 kilohertz ultrasonic. So we've obviously had to shift down the frequency for us to be able to hear them. Now, it didn't really sound like individual clicks, but I can assure you, if we slow that right down, you would hear the individual pings essentially coming out from the porpoise's melon. So the way the cetaceans...
Sorry, from the porpoise's what?
The porpoise's melon. So the way the cetaceans, the whales and dolphins, over the millennia, they've evolved quite a unique way of interacting with the world. So for us, humans, our primary sense or... Or a way of interacting with the world is through our eyes, really. So we're very visual creatures, and many of our other senses are largely secondary. Those of us that have cats or dogs at home, for example, they are often using their olfactory sense or their nose, so they can smell things. And if you see a dog or a cat following a trail, you'll see exactly what's going on there. For the whales and dolphins, it's all about the acoustic world. So they often live in quite murky waters. They're not necessarily clean, pristine Caribbean type waters, particularly somewhere like the River Thames that could potentially be quite murky. Also, these animals don't really sleep traditionally like we would, or our cats and dogs would. They tend to be active 24 hours a day with short bursts of sleep-like rest. So they need to forage and find their way around at night when it's dark, so obviously they can't really rely on their eyes then. So they're almost entirely reliant on their acoustic sense. So over the years, they've developed a very specific and sensitive bit of kit. So they actually project noise through their forehead or their melon. So if you look at if you think of a kind of quintessential characteristic dolphin, for example, and they have quite a big bulbous forehead, that's actually a fatty tissue that they use to focus a sound beam forward. So they produce a click, for example, or a whistle in the case of a dolphin. In the air sacs that run throughout the front of their head, this fatty tissue acts as a lens, much like we use the lens in our eye to focus light beams. They use the lens of their melon to focus the sound beam forward into the water column. This sound will propel forward. If it's a click, for example, their sonar, a click will travel forward, hit a fish, for example, get bounced back. Now, that returning echo will actually get transmitted up through the jawbone of the animal's head. So again, they have a very fine porcelain-like bone structure. They've got very fine bones in their lower jaw, but they're again packed with this fatty tissue, which acts as a very good propagator to transmit noise up to their inner ear. So unlike us, they don't have great big flaps hanging out the side of their head like us and our cats and dogs. They don't have external ears because they need to be streamlined in the water. But they do have the inner ear, or the very centre of the hearing system, is essentially the same as ours. So there are some, the nuts and bolts of the hearing system are the same as ours. They produce a sound and then they hear it with their inner ear, but it's just the pathway they use to deliver sound and receive sound are completely different. So imagine us if we spoke through our forehead and listened through our mouth. That's essentially what a harbour porpoise is doing.
I've been sitting here imagining exactly that, and it's made me see the porpoise and the dolphin in an entirely different way. And there was something you said about dolphins there. I thought dolphins were renowned for their clicks, and you're saying they whistle.
That's right. So almost all of the toothed whales produce echolocation clicks. So there's a big split, if you like, a big rift in the world of the cetaceans or whales and dolphins. What we traditionally think of as whales are actually the baleen whales, or the great whales. So the baleen whales, rather than teeth, they have baleen in their mouth, which are like great curtains of this great fibrous mass. It's actually keratin, the same material that our fingernails are made of. But in the mouth of a baleen whale, it will form as these great curtains, and they're filter feeders, so they actually use these curtains as a sieve.
So plankton and so forth.
Exactly, so they'll gulp in the great thousands of litres of water with each gulp and sieve out these tiny little crustaceans, the tiny little shrimp, and that's primarily their diet. Now that means these baleen whales, they need to feed in areas where there's massive aggregations of these krill, and that typically only occurs in the summer months in the high latitude areas, the North Pole, the South Pole. So these baleen whales are pretty much confined to undertaking a vast migration. So sometimes if people go on holiday to certain areas, they might see migrating whales. We tend to see less of it in the UK, But in certain areas, like of California, for example, you can visit certain headlands at certain times of the year, South Africa, and see these great beasts migrating up and down the coast. And they're actually heading from the tropical breeding grounds to these summer feeding grounds. And there's about 20 species of these great whales that do take that path. The rest, the other 60, 70 or so other species are the toothed whales. So instead of the baleen, instead of the curtains in their mouth, they have teeth. Similar to our teeth, but they tend to be very sharp, conical teeth. So we have a whole mix of different types of teeth in our mouth. They just have one type of tooth, these very sharp, conical teeth, because they are primarily interested in just grabbing fish or squid from the water column and generally swallowing them whole. So there isn't much chewing going on, so they don't need molars, for example, like us. But anyway, it means because they have a very different, these toothed whales have a very different way of feeding, it means they need a different way of finding their food. So they all rely on their sonar, their echolocation clicks, to find the food. They tend to feed in tight groups, often family groups, and so therefore certain species have developed a whole range of social signals. And many people are probably aware of the squawks and squeaks and whistles of things like dolphins and killer whales. Those animals, if they're kept in captivity, for example, they can be heard quite easily in the tanks. They're often encouraged to produce this wide repertoire of sounds. But in the wild, we find they do also have this remarkable range of sounds they can produce. And they're mostly for social interaction, so it may be that certain types of call are used in aggressive situations. So if two males are fighting, competing, they'll probably produce a certain type of aggressive sound. Yeah, a mother and a calf, for example, a mother with a young will produce what's called a signature whistle. So a certain type of whistle that the calf can very easily identify as coming from the mother. So it helps prevent the two animals getting separated. Certain types of sound are produced when they're foraging, feeding, because they often feed cooperatively. They often feed in a large group, and they often help each other feed. So some animals within a group, some of the dolphins will corral the fish, herd the fish, while others come through and grab them. And they seem to have quite a good society in place, whereby everyone gets a chance, or every dolphin gets a chance, to whiz in, grab a fish, move on, herd the fish. So they've evolved quite a good social system, but it relies on them having this very elaborate communication system as well.
We know, any Star Trek fan knows, that humpback whales can communicate with spaceships from the past.
Well, of course. I mean, that's a well-known scientific fact.
London's most famous recent cetacean experience was a sad one. The whale who came up the Thames and didn't go back down the Thames. What was that whale's mission, do you think?
Well, that was a very interesting story. That the whale in question was originally called Willie, I think, but then they realised that it wasn't actually the most appropriate name. It was a female northern bottlenose whale. So this species of whale are very rare visitors to the UK. They tend to be found only in the very deep waters. They're really deep divers. They can dive to over 2,000 metres and hold their breath for up to an hour. So again, it's an avenue that the cetaceans, the whales and dolphins, have exploited, and it seems very hard for us to imagine diving for an hour to 2,000 metres. But some of these deep divers, they're called beaked whales. The group of animals are called beaked whales because they are whales with beaks, essentially. The northern bottlenose whale is one of those species. So typically it would be in very deep waters, a long way offshore, so perhaps more towards Iceland, so halfway between the UK and Iceland, the water starts to get very deep, or to the west off the Outer Hebrides, for example, these animals are sometimes seen there. But it's very unusual for a whale like that to come down. It must have come down the east coast of the UK and made a wrong turn at some point and gone into the Thames. So it may be that the animal was lost or disorientated or confused. The jury's still out, but occasionally we do get these slightly odd sightings, or these slightly odd sightings of creatures that are out of season or out of their traditional home range. Sometimes it's a good sign. Sometimes that means actually a population is really healthy, if the population is growing to such an extent that it's typically the younger members of the community start ranging off and looking for a place to call home. But sometimes it can be a bit alarming. And so that was a slightly sad story, because that was a species that probably shouldn't have been coming down the North Sea. It really was in the wrong place and certainly at the wrong time.
And I should say, by the way, as this broadcast goes to air, you will be in the Thames estuary or up the Thames, because this is going out this weekend, so people could be looking out for your green flag fluttering over the boat. What will be a sign for you that, from a conservation point of view, things are looking good?
Well, we're actually overjoyed that there are porpoises being seen anyway, harbour porpoises being seen in the Thames, because 60 or so years ago, the River Thames was declared biologically dead. Now, with successive efforts to clean up the Thames, everyone's made a sterling effort. There are now, for example, over 120 species of fish now using the river. So it's gone from being dead to harbouring 120 species of fish. Just to put that in some kind of perspective, the Nile, the longest river system in the world, also supports 120 species of fish. And that's 6,000 kilometres long. So we've done really well. We should be really proud with what we've done with our river. It's one of the cleanest waterways in a metropolis in the world. So to be frank, any sighting of a charismatic mammal, such as a harbour porpoise or seals, grey seals and common seals, have been seen increasingly regularly in the River Thames as well, coming in on the mudflats. So any signs like that actually are a great victory, a great conservation victory. So really the purpose of this survey is to be trying to get a feel for exactly how many there are and where they are. And that's really the first stepping stone, if you like, in working towards preserving the River Thames as a habitat for harbour porpoises, for not for only for themselves, but also for us, for future generations. It'd be great if people in London and our children and our grandchildren can look out on a sunny day and see a harbour porpoise cruising up the Thames. What a fantastic sight.
And of course you'll, I'm sure, be doing all the social media stuff as you head along the river. Can people follow you on Twitter and Facebook and those things?
Yes, so our webpage is www.marineconservationresearch.org, all one word, and people can follow us on Facebook and Twitter as well. We're encouraging as many people this weekend to get out and about in London looking for porpoises. So we are arranging a number of observation schemes along the course of the Thames on the Saturday. And then this Sunday we'll be having an open day on the boat at Hermitage Community Moorings, which is in Wapping. So we're encouraging people to come along. We'll be running the open day from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the Sunday. So anyone that wants to come and learn a little bit more about our work, to meet us, to see the vessel, to perhaps listen to some porpoises we've recorded on the way in up the River Thames, we'd be glad to have people on board.
And I can testify that the crew aboard, to a person, is a smiley, friendly crew, extremely approachable, exactly the sort of people that you'd want looking after the marine life of the Thames. Oliver Boisset, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Richard McClanagan and Oliver Boisset. Thanks too to Anna Cutlaw, Mark Barr and Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea, quite appropriately. I'm in Quentin Wolfe.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.